KTOO Public Media would like to acknowledge the Flay-Nay-Di and the Woosh-Kitan of the Ak-Kwan. We are on their ancestral homeland. Our broadcast studios are built on fill that was once tideland and part of what is called the Indian Village. We recognize those families who regarded the tidelands as a source of food and part of their home, and who have never relinquished their property rights and hunting and fishing rights, nor their ownership and stewardship of their land and waterway. The families of the Juneau Indian Village, like their ancestors, cherish and depend upon their immediate connection to the waterfront. KTOO is working to lift up Tlingit voices through the sharing of stories like these and the broadcast of the Tlingit language. Please excuse us for our mistakes and gunos chish for your patience as we learn.
Hansen Gress, ka eat with the shu yi, we ka shuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta khanakhaya ha ane kak, gunos chish.
You're tuned in to Juneau Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and my first guest today is Zach Brown, this week's featured speaker for Evening at Egan. Welcome to the show, Zach.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
It's lovely to have you. Would you please introduce yourself for our listeners and tell us a bit about what you do?
Sure, yeah. I am over in Gustavus, so about 60, 80 miles west across the fjords, and I am the director of Inian Islands Institute. We're a field school that does experiential education, bringing students out into the wilds and teaching them about sustainability and subsistence practices and climate change. And I'm a climate scientist in a former life, and now more of a climate educator and activist.
That must be an interesting life out there at the Inian Islands Institute. How has it been going for you all this year?
You know, a radically altered season. We, of course, had to cancel all of our student groups who were going to be coming through. But a skeleton crew out on the island managed to make a lot of progress in building up our campus. And so whenever students are coming back, they're going to be walking into a world-class spot. It's very beautiful out there.
I saw some pictures online. It's definitely worth checking out if you're not familiar with it already. Well, thanks for sharing that bit of info. The title of your talk this Friday night is The True Nature of the Climate Crisis. Now, to me, that implies we are operating under assumptions about the nature of the climate crisis, which are not true. What would you say is the meaning of that title?
Yeah, to me, there is a lot of misinformation and disinformation out there about the climate crisis. Not just climate change denial, but also the best ways of responding to it. I think that there's been a lot of money and resources spent trying to convince people to blame themselves, and that changing our own ways and trying to reduce our own carbon footprint is the way out of this mess. When in fact, what that really does, although those things are important and can really improve our quality of life, what that does is take our eyes off of the big picture, which is the need to change the system. This is a systemic crisis that requires systemic action, and personal changes can only nibble at the edges.
You're quoted as saying, like all successful social movements, from workers' rights to civil rights to gay rights, it begins not with individual action to reduce our own carbon footprint, but confronting the structural impediments to change. The sea change in climate action in our historical moment is being driven by civil disobedience and political mobilization. That kind of sums up what you just said. Is there anything else you want to expand upon on that statement?
Yeah, I just say, you know, I think people are rightly focused on what can I do as an individual to help us out of this mess. It seems so massive, so overwhelming, involving every nation on earth and every person on earth and billions of actors. God, what could I possibly do to make a difference? But people don't realize that this concept of the personal carbon footprint was actually invented by BP, British Petroleum, one of the major oil industries, in 2005 in a $100 million ad campaign to convince people exactly that, to blame themselves and to take the blame away from where it rightly rests, which is with the fossil fuel industry, which has spent millions misleading the public and their own investors about the threats of climate change, and then lobbying the government and financing campaigns of politicians who deny and refuse to act on this crisis. So reframing where this blame appropriately sits is where I see a lot of my work. And I guess I would just say to my students, I say that riding a bike, planting a garden, getting to know your local farmer, going to the farmer's market, and various other things that we do to reduce our own carbon footprint, by all means, do those things, but do them because they make us happy and healthy to reduce our use of fossil fuels. Don't do them because they're going to fix the climate crisis. They won't. What Bill McKibben, one of our greatest climate champions today, says is, he gets this question all the time, what can I do as an individual to help this? And his answer, become less of an individual. Join the movement for climate justice. And there's a number of pieces to that movement. Right now, the most important, of course, is electing leaders who will take strong climate action. And we have 40 days to do that.
Thank you for that reminder, and thank you for saying all of those, for voicing all of those sentiments. Is this part of what you'll be covering in your talk on Friday?
I will.
And what else will you be covering?
You know, I'm going to talk a little bit about my background as a climate scientist and some of the impacts that we've been seeing here in Alaska. But I'm gonna whisk through that pretty quickly because I think there have been an awful lot of fascinating and entertaining talks on evenings at Egan and all kinds of other forums about climate science and all of the devastating impacts that are happening. And I think people are rightly focused on what can I do? And I believe that I can help people see through some of the fog a little bit because I've studied this very closely.
How has your time at the Indian Islands Institute influenced your outlook or your approach to this topic?
Well, I suppose I could sum up our mission at Indian Islands Institute as helping to educate and inspire the next generation of environmental leaders. And so I think one thing that it does is to help ground all of these concepts in a vision for what we'd like to see in the future. You know, at our little campus out there at the Indian Islands, we're surrounded by beautiful intact wildlands, and a lot of our food we can get from the local land around us, and we have this amazing little community out there, and it's something that is truly eye-opening for these students, many of whom are coming from urban environments and never even knew that a place like this existed. And so if you can give them some tools for tackling the climate crisis, that's one thing. Going up against the entrenched power of industry, electing climate champions, those kinds of things. But all of that isn't so meaningful if it's not coupled with a vision for what we're trying to build, a vision for the future. And so I like to think that at Indian Islands Institute, we can do a bit of both. We can give students the tools to be activists and to help build a better world. But building a better world requires a vision for how things could be.
And speaking of vision, the state of Michigan has announced that it intends to be, I believe, climate neutral or carbon neutral by the year 2050. What do you think it would take for Alaska, other states, the nation to get to that point? China has announced that it would like to achieve that by 2060.
Yeah, we're seeing just a proliferation of these kinds of pledges. And I think that they are well within our reach. That's another of the pieces of disinformation that's out there. Again, largely funded by the fossil fuel industry, is to downplay the enormous exponential increases that we're seeing in renewable energy technology, which is has just blown all of the expert predictions out of the water in terms of how quickly things have been coming online and how quickly prices have been coming down. And so I think that these pledges are very realistic. I think that most of them don't go far enough, but one of the tenets of the Paris Climate Accords that were signed in December of 2015 was they had this ratcheting effect where each year that nations came back together, they would up the ante and make their pledges even stronger. The theory being that the more you do, the more you can do, because you just climb and climb that learning curve. And so I think that a lot of nations around the world are well along that learning curve. And I think that the United States and Alaska are really falling behind. And that is mostly a consequence of the unchecked power of the fossil fuel industry that's stopping us from making change.
And in your opinion, I know a lot of people have said a lot about this. What are the consequences of not changing?
Boy, yeah, there's a lot out there. If you really want to depress yourself, I encourage you to read The Uninhabitable Earth by David Wallace Wells. We're heading in a really tough direction and very quickly. The United Nations estimates that we have that this crucial decade, the 2020s, will really seal our fate when it comes to the climate crisis. And they say if we don't cut global emissions in half by 2030, we're going to be going on a path that leads towards the flooding of Earth's major coastal cities, agricultural collapse that leads to famine and a refugee crisis beyond imagining, wildfires, droughts, and hurricanes that will cost hundreds of billions in damages. We're already seeing a lot of that going on. And so these kinds of the death of all coral reefs and swaths of you know, the Middle East, North Africa, and other areas becoming actually uninhabitable because of heat that humans can't withstand. And so we're really in for it if we don't mobilize and quickly. And I can't impress enough how crucial this election is.
You've mentioned that the message of the individual carbon footprint has gone mainstream with the help of major corporations. How or what would it take to make your message go mainstream, that it is the major corporations who need to change and not necessarily the individuals?
I think that that's really going mainstream as we speak. It's really the climate movement has really hit its stride over the last 5 or 10 years. You know, there was a lot of wasted energy talking about protecting polar bears and that kind of thing. There was a lot of wasted energy trying to do market-friendly solutions that would be appealing to conservatives and things like this. And in that time, you know, since the 1980s, when the climate action really tried to get started, emissions have just skyrocketed. So those tacts have utterly failed. So now, as I said, the climate movement has really begun to come of age. And it's this reframing around climate justice. And what we're seeing is just the linkages are becoming so clear between climate change and some of the other crises that we face, from extreme inequality to coronavirus. And so these links help draw the various social justice movements together. And then you have things like nominees across the nation, primarily Democratic nominees, unfortunately, I wish it was all over, but are rejecting corporate donations and are signing pledges not to take money from fossil fuel interests. And this goes a long way towards transparency, towards de-corrupting our political process so that the corporations don't own the politicians anymore. And so this is these are really positive steps towards understanding where the blame should truly lie and towards systemic change rather than individual change.
How does knowing what you know or what you've learned in your research influence the way you live your own life?
Yeah, I think about carbon with every decision that I make. You know, my wife Laura, it drives her nuts because we have a Toyo in the house, and I keep it 10 degrees cooler than she would like. And but we really do our best. We bike all over town. Gustavus is very bike friendly, and we're getting better at gardening. We pulled about 30 coho salmon out of the Bartlett River this year, and we've got a pantry full of local food. So we're really happy about these steps. But you know, we do use fossil fuels, and it's so difficult to square, you know, the necessity of that, because we're trapped in this fossil fuel addled society like everyone else. But things are starting to change in that direction, and it's really exciting to see. I think back when I begin to worry ever so naturally about my own impact on the world, I'm reminded of something my buddy Hank said, which was, you know, when Abraham Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address, he was wearing a cotton shirt, and that cotton was picked by slaves. And the point being that just because you are trapped within an unjust system, that doesn't mean that you can't advocate for its change. And I would argue we have a moral obligation to advocate for its change.
Zach Brown, featured speaker for Evening at Egan this Friday. I deeply admire your enthusiasm and your passion for this topic. The talk is 7:00. You can attend free via Zoom, and we have the link to the registration up on our website, ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. Zach, anything else you'd like to add or share with our audience before we say goodbye today?
I just love to see everybody getting busy for the next 40 days. As someone, as a wise person put it, the weekend is 40 days away. Well, you know, what would you do for the next 40 days if the fate of the biosphere and human society were on the line?
That's a great way of putting it. Again, thanks so much for speaking with me today, and I hope you have a great lecture on Friday.
Thanks a lot.